We're delighted again this evening to have Dr. Roy Fuller with us. In case you haven't been with us, and most of you have, I think, Dr. Fuller is a professor at the University of Louisville. He has also taught at various other colleges, universities, and seminaries, including Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. His specialty is world religions. He has been leading us in a study of Judaism and Jewish-Christian relations. This is the third or fourth time, Roy, the third time that we've had him here at Calvary Baptist Church. He's led us in a study of Islam and did a superb job in that, and then looked at some alternative Christianities as we examined and explored Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses and looked at some issues as that as well. So he is a favorite among us at Calvary. I'm sure we'll have him back again in the future. His wife, I found out, is a librarian and archivist at the University of Louisville, so she's very interested in history. He has two teenage daughters. Are they still teenagers, or is one? They're still teenagers. One's 20. Okay, so she's out of the teenage years. But we appreciate him, and I so much appreciate the church of which he is a part, the Highland Baptist Church. We appreciate that wonderful sister church there and the ministry that they do. So with that, I'm going to have a prayer and then ask Roy if he would come and lead us in the study. Thank you, gracious God, for fellowship. We've enjoyed that tonight around these tables, and the laughter and the clanking of dishes and silverware reminds us that fellowship's a really good thing. Thank you for the opportunity to be church together. And tonight I want to give thanks for our sister church, the Highland Baptist Church. Thank you for their ministerial staff, and thank you for the ministry that they perform not only in Louisville but around the world. So continue to bless that congregation. And we do give thanks to you for the teaching ministry of Dr. Fuller. Thank you for his willingness to come and to share his teaching gifts with us. Be with us this evening that we might have a better understanding of our Jewish brothers and sisters. We entrust one another now to your care, and we pray in Christ's name. Amen. So, Roy?
Is it? Maybe I pushed this the wrong. Is that better? Okay, now I hear it. So, thank you. Very good to be back with you folks again. Enjoy coming over here. Haven't worn out my welcome, I guess, so that's good. We've been doing this 3 weeks on Judaism, Jewish-Christian relations, and tonight I really want to focus on the relations part, the Jewish-Christian relations part. We spent the first week really looking at the development of Rabbinic Judaism, which is really the foundation for all modern Jews and Judaism. And then last week we looked at the different types of Jews, different branches of Judaism, and Orthodox, and conservative, and reform, and so forth. And so what I want to do tonight is look at the whole area of Jewish-Christian relations. And as you see, I've identified several areas here for some discussion. You know, when it comes to issues between Jews and Christians, there's probably some other categories you could certainly identify here, but I think there are certainly theological issues. There are issues related to beliefs, differences in beliefs, and so forth. There are historical differences between Jews and Christians. There's a big question about the relationship between these two groups, the treatment often that was experienced by Jews at the hands of Christians. And we're going to talk about that tonight. That's a big issue in Jewish-Christian relations. And in my experience, at least, Jews are well aware of this history, and Christians are not so well aware of this history. And so this is an issue in Jewish-Christian relations, these differences in how they have looked at this historic relationship. Anti-Semitism. And we'll take a look at that in a little more depth. And then, of course, there's a whole host of contemporary issues on which Jews and Christians can both agree and disagree. And so hopefully after tonight you'll have a little bit of a sense of what, you know, dialogue with Jews is about, some of the issues that come up, and hopefully some of the we'll be able to increase our sensitivity perhaps as to how the other side, as it were, looks at certain things. So next slide, please. Some of the theological issues that always come up, of course, and I put the number one there, who was Jesus? Now, obviously, Christians have an answer for that question. Christians have a lot of answers for that question. as to who Jesus was. Jews certainly have opinions about Jesus. In fact, part of my interest in this whole topic grew out of my dissertation. I did a dissertation on how modern Jews look at and understand Jesus. And it was a fascinating study. But I will tell you that most modern Jews haven't given too much thought to Jesus. They don't have to. Christianity, and this is where I would make this statement. There is, when you think about Jewish-Christian relations, there is something of, you might say, an unevenness to it, or an asymmetry, I guess we'd say. Christianity, of course, is always, and we know this, Christianity has always built itself on a Jewish foundation. Now sometimes we've denied that, sometimes we've ignored that, but Christianity is built on, right? We have the Hebrew Bible as part of our Bible, right? And so we have built on a foundation. And so there has always been some interest in understanding Judaism. Jews, on the other hand, being the faith tradition that preceded Christianity, never had to give much thought to Christianity. They don't have to define themselves against Christians. They've always been able to define themselves without taking any note of Christianity. And so, whereas Christians have an interest in Judaism, Jews do not necessarily have an interest in Christianity. So when it comes to this question of who was Jesus, you get all kinds of answers. I have a friend, she's a rabbi. She's a Reform rabbi. Had a group of students I took to her synagogue, and there was a question and answer time. And first question from one of the students to my friend, who's a rabbi, said, "Well, what do you think about Jesus?" I didn't know what she was going to say, but she had a great answer, I thought. She said, "Well, I think of Jesus as a Reform rabbi," which I thought was a great answer on her part. She does think of Jesus as a Reform rabbi. She sees Jesus as a reformer in the time, at his time, and so forth. So this is a big question. This is a whole area of questions. And I would say this gets right at the heart, obviously, of Jewish-Christian relations. The identity of Jesus is really one of the biggest things that separates Jews and Christians as to who he was and so forth and who he is. And so this is a big question. And I gave you an example there, like the term Messiah. For instance, we're familiar with that term. Christians have always used that term, Jesus the Messiah, or in Greek, Jesus the Christ, same meaning. And so it raises a question, well, Christians always have understood Jesus as the Messiah, whereas clearly Jews have not accepted this claim that Jesus was the Messiah. And so, you know, these are the kinds of issues that come up. Number two, there's a big area that comes up in Jewish-Christian relations, and that is how to interpret the Hebrew Bible. We typically call it the Old Testament. But how to interpret the Hebrew Bible. Christians made a decision very early, didn't they? We're going to keep that. You may or may not know, some Christians thought in the first and second century, we shouldn't keep that. We shouldn't keep the Hebrew Bible. It's not ours. It's a different God. Marcion, who was a second century heretic, said, Christians should not use the Hebrew Bible. But as you know, because we all have Bibles and we know that there's an Old Testament and a New Testament, the church decided, right? We are going to keep that text. It's our text too. And so here we have a situation where you have two religions, Christians and Jews, who share the same text. Now, they don't read it the same way in all cases, or in many cases, they don't read it the same way. So this comes up quite a bit because, of course, this is, on the one hand, common ground. You can say, hey, let's talk about Isaiah. Let's talk about what Jeremiah says. We share the text. And yet, when you begin to read, it's pretty clear that in some cases you don't share the interpretation. I had a very interesting experience with this issue. I did some graduate work up at Hebrew Union College. Anybody know Hebrew Union College? Up in Cincinnati. Main training school for Reform rabbis in the world. It's up in Cincinnati. Well, a Reform rabbi, or this is the more, you may recall from last week, it was sort of the more progressive branch or the more liberal branch. They have females who serve as rabbis and so forth. And so they have a training school up in Cincinnati. Yes, yes, a leader. And so they do their training there. And so there were some of us who were at the seminary at the time, and three of us took a class there. And so here we were. We'd come in every week, the three Baptists from Louisville. All the rest of the students in the class were rabbis in training. The professor, I should mention this, the professor was quite interesting. He was a Reform rabbi, no surprise there, who taught Christian literature. He had a PhD in New Testament. This is a small club. Reform rabbis who have a PhD in New Testament. It's a small club. I think he was the only one in it for a while. The class that I was taking was a class in how Christians use the Hebrew scriptures. And so we were Christians, and you know, they were really curious about us. They were amazed at our ability to read passages from the Hebrew Bible and find Jesus. They were amazed. They were stunned, really, I would say. They were stunned at how we could. I said, well, you know, we're not brilliant. We've grown up with this, you know. We're used to this. But it was very interesting because here we are. We were Jews and Christians sitting in the same classroom looking at the same text. And they were amazed at how Christians would look at a text that they themselves were very, very familiar with, and how we looked at it in a very, very different kind of way. So this is an issue that always comes up, this issue of how to interpret text. Now, of course, Jews don't have too much interest, or at least historically have not had much interest in the New Testament, because it's not their text. Modern Jews have had some interest in it, and so they are taking more of an interest in it. And I would say in the last, 40 to 50 years especially, you've had a lot of Jews that have been interested in Jesus because they see Jesus as a Jew. They say he's one of ours. And we could acknowledge that. And so they have opinions about him. And I would say that this is a relatively new development. And so this is why you're seeing an increasing number of Jewish scholars who are specializing in Jesus studies. It's a really interesting development. We're going to have one of them in Louisville in a few weeks, Amy Jill Levine, who's down at Vanderbilt. She's a Jewish scholar. She's a Jew. She's a practicing Jew. And her specialty is the New Testament. And she's going to come to and talk to us about Jewish-Christian relations. I think it's going to be interesting, you know. And so this is a new development in some ways, but this is always an issue. And, of course, a subset of that issue is number three up there. Jews have always been interested in how Jews and Judaism are portrayed in the New Testament. They don't need to study the New Testament. It's not their text, but they are interested in how Jews and Judaism are portrayed in the New Testament. And I would say this, that if you've studied the New Testament, if you've looked at it from a historical perspective, as time goes by, there is increasing tension in the New Testament. By the time you get to the Gospel of John, which we think was the last gospel written, by the time you get to the Gospel of John, the discussion is about Jesus and the Jews, right? Jesus and the Jews. Before that, it's like in Matthew, it's like Jesus and some of the Jews, right? The Pharisees and the Sadducees and so forth. He has a conflict with them. But by the time you get to John, it's Jesus versus all the Jews, as if he were not a Jew himself, right? And so this grows over time, and this tension grows over time. And so this is an issue that Jews have had some interest in. And I think that this is actually a very ripe ground for discussion between Jews and Christians. Next slide, please. Historical differences. You know, we all know Christianity started, of course, in the Roman Empire, right? Started in the Roman Empire. It was one religion among many. There were a lot of religions in the Roman Empire. And one of the great fascinating parts of Christian history is how did Christianity go from being what must have been a very small movement at the beginning, right, to becoming the legal religion of the Roman Empire in three centuries? How did that happen? And it's a fascinating story, which we don't have time for. But what we can say is that by the time Christianity became, what should we say, the winner? They won the lottery. They won the prize, right? They become the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. By the time that happens, that's a dramatic shift in power. Christians found that now they could restrict, they could destroy their enemies. Whether their enemies be other Christians who had wrong beliefs, we could call them heretics, right? We all know how heretics were treated, right? Poorly, badly, killed in some cases. They didn't kill heretics before this. They didn't have the power to kill heretics. They weren't interested in killing heretics. But now, once the state is involved, what happens? You've got church and state together. And now Christians get power. And once they got power, if you were an enemy of the state, you were an enemy of the church. And Jews, unfortunately, found themselves in that category. They had differences of opinions with Christians. They had disputes with Christians, but now maybe they weren't good citizens either. And so this is when things begin to, in a sense, you might say, go badly between Jews and Christians. Now, it wasn't like there wasn't bad feelings before. It wasn't like there wasn't animosity before. But now one side has all the power, and the other side has very, very little power. And so beginning even as early as the 4th and 5th century, you would see things like public burning of Talmuds, for instance. Remember the Talmud? This is the Jewish writing that had been put together. You see restrictions placed on Jews. They weren't allowed to have certain occupations. Sometimes they couldn't own land, which meant they couldn't farm and things like that. Their rights as citizens were often restricted. They really didn't have rights as citizens. And that continues through much of the next few centuries, I would say. Things go from bad to worse, beginning with the Crusades. Everybody know the Crusades? You know what we all know the Crusades, right? And if you ask most people on the street, well, what were the Crusades about? They'd say what? They'd say, well, that's when Christians gathered their armies and went to fight who? Muslims, right? And that's true. That's exactly what they were about. Christian armies gathered in Europe, and they marched overland to reclaim the Holy Land. That's what the Crusades were about. So the idea was to go and fight Muslims, because they were infidels. That was the word they would use, infidels. But the logic of the crusade affected Jews. I mean, think about it. If you're a Christian in France and you're told, okay, we're going to march 3,000 miles to kill infidels, you have infidels living in your backyard. Who are they? Jews. Jews were living all over Europe. The logic of the crusade was the infidel must be eliminated. They're heretics. And so along the way, and this is documented and it's unfortunately true, as Christian armies marched toward the Holy Land, they slaughtered Jewish communities. A lot of this occurred in the Rhine Valley and so forth, because the logic was such that you must be like us. If you're not like us, you're different from us, and we're going to kill people who are different from us. And oh, here, by the way, these people are different from us too. And so the relationship between Jews and Christians in Europe really deteriorates with the Crusades. Jews are well aware of this history. I suspect most Christians don't know anything about the Jewish role in the Crusades, how Jews were killed, how Jewish communities were wiped out in the Crusades. And so again, this is sort of that historical perspective that I was noting earlier, this historical difference. So beginning with the Crusades, the first Crusade is 1095. So beginning with the Crusades, it gets a little bit worse for Jews, certainly. You begin to see a real rise in popular, oh, I call them stereotypes, and scapegoating at this point. There were all kinds of things. I am constantly amazed, and I've looked at some of this. I'm constantly amazed at the things that Christians would believe about Jews in the Middle Ages. It's amazing to me what they would believe. We all know the plague, right? The Black Death, the plague. Black Death was terrible. A third of the population died. Everybody's asking themselves, why? One of the very popular claims as to the why was that Jews were responsible for the plague. Now think about that. Millions of dead people, and people are pointing a finger at this very small minority population saying they're responsible for this. So they were blamed for the Black Death. They were blamed for breaking it. They said that Jews would break into Christian churches and they would desecrate the host. In other words, they would go and they would either steal the bread or do something to the bread that Christians used for the Eucharist. they would, there was another myth that was spread about Jews in the Middle Ages that was widely believed, it was all over Europe, that Jews would kidnap Christian children and they would ritually sacrifice them and they would use their blood in their rituals. Now, again, I don't know what worse thing you could really say, right, about a group of people. And it also goes to show the Christian misunderstanding of Judaism. Were Jews sacrificing anything in the Middle Ages? No, they had stopped doing that, right? We talked about rabbinic Judaism. The whole point was they don't offer sacrifices anymore. So it kind of goes to show you Christians had a really deep misunderstanding of Judaism at many levels. So they would, these kinds of stories would spread. There were Christians in the Middle Ages who believed as fact that Jews were born with horns. And they said these horns were cut off and that this was part of the circumcision ritual. I had a hard time believing that one. I mean, I did. I had a hard time believing that, but it's true. It is true. You know, there's a famous statue, right? You all know the famous statue of Moses in Rome?
Yep.
With horns? Now, that's from a mistranslation of the text where it says Moses' face shone. Remember when Moses would go in to see God and he came out, his face was shining, and he covered his face with a veil? There was a mistranslation of that that said Moses had horns. Michelangelo carved a very famous statue of Moses with horns. You can Google it later tonight. You can find it on the internet. It's there. It's still there. So these were things that were widely believed about a group of people that Christians saw as different, as the other, as heretics and infidels, and they were responsible, after all, they were responsible for the death of Christ, right? So the charge of Christ killer comes in. Next slide, please. Hope you can see this. This was one of the best images I could find. What you have here is a very common portrayal in the Middle Ages of the church and the synagogue. Usually, these are found on cathedrals. This is from a cathedral. Sometimes it was found in the other artwork and paintings and so forth. And on, let's see, your left is the church. You see the woman standing there. She's got a crown on. She's holding the cup. She's holding this staff and so forth. And the woman on your right, is representing the synagogue. And a couple things I would point out. One, she's got a staff too, but it's broken. Notice that? It's broken. The staff represents the covenant. The covenant was broken. Her crown is not on her head, but it's laying at her feet. The crown has fallen off her head. And you can't really see this in the picture, but I think in her right hand, the tablets of the Torah, the tablets of the Ten Commandments, she's holding them, but she's dropping them. They're slipping from her hand. And you may notice, too, her eyes are covered, right? She's veiled. She's blind. She can't read and understand her own text, that being the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. This was an extremely common image, you know, so you didn't have to read, of course, in the Middle Ages. All you had to do is go to church and you would see this. This is theology in stone, right? It's not subtle. It is not subtle. You know, who is the inheritor of the covenant? Who's the inheritor of all the promises? The church. Who has forfeited everything? The synagogue. This was basically reinforced people's thinking. Well, yeah, this is how it is, you know, and so forth. And so this was a very common image. Next slide, please. Two things I would say here. One, anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism. Now, we're familiar perhaps more with the term anti-Semitism, right? Anti-Semitism is really hatred of Jews and Judaism. It's hatred of Jews and Judaism. Anti-Judaism is a little different than that. As I defined it, anti-Judaism is negative attitudes and statements regarding Jews and Judaism. And I put the statement there, the question, is the New Testament anti-Jewish? Well, are there statements in the New Testament that are anti-Jewish? Yes. Why? Well, because early Christians were trying to distinguish themselves, right? We're saying, this is who we are, and we're not them. I tell my students, this is natural normal. When a new religion is coming on the scene, what do? This is who we are, and I want to tell you, we are different from them, right? And they want to say, what else? We are better than them. Is this normal? Yes. This is completely normal. It's natural. So, sure, there are passages in the New Testament which I would describe as anti-Jewish. To me, that's really to be expected. Now, I do not think and would not say that they are anti-Semitic, because anti-Semitism is hatred of Jews and Judaism. And I don't think you see that. You don't see it yet, anyway. It comes down the road pretty soon. And as I put there at the bottom, at some point, and it's really hard to pinpoint this, but at some point, the natural religious conflict, the natural religious animosity between Jews and Christians crosses the line. It crosses a line. And whenever that occurred, the line was crossed, and Christians from that point forward really began to believe, as I said, just about anything. They would believe almost anything about Jews, no matter how wild, no matter how crazy on the face of it, they were willing to believe it. And of course, you know, people were taught this, right? They were taught. There was even a name for this teaching. It was called the teaching of contempt. The teaching of contempt. Contempt for Jews and Judaism. Now, if you turn to the next slide, please. Thank you. I want to give you a selection here. And the first one is Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr was an important figure in the second century. He wrote a number of tracts which have survived. He was a significant theologian. And Justin Martyr is credited or blamed for being the first person to come up with this phrase, Christ killer. Jews were Christ killers. And once he puts it out there, the label sticks. Everybody after Justin Martyr refers to Jews as Christ killers. Now, you all know the Gospels, of course. You know that when Jesus was arrested, there were Jews involved. Absolutely right. We know that that's in our text, and we know that that's true. The question here was, of course, is, well, does that mean all Jews forever should be held accountable for what those Jews did? That was the question here. And so Justin is saying, yes, they murdered the just one. They are the Christ killers, he is saying here. And then the next one is Augustine. We all know Augustine, right? Augustine, great theologian in the early church, was in the 4th and 5th century, bishop in North Africa, hugely influential. He was the one. Augustine articulates this idea that, well, the church, the Christian church, is the new Israel. The Christian church is the new Israel, as he puts it. We are Israel, the seed of Abraham. Let no Christian consider himself alien to the name of Israel. And so this idea sort of takes root. And of course, this is certainly one of the images we see. We see this in the New Testament, right? This image of the new Israel and so forth. So it's ingrained in Scripture and so forth. The question that is posed here is that, well, if Christians are the new Israel, what about the old Israel? What happens to them? What should happen to them? These were questions that Augustine and others were trying to answer. Augustine is also responsible for what is called the witness people. Augustine said, Jews, we shouldn't kill Jews, which sounds good, right? We shouldn't kill Jews. And I want to give him credit for this, because at least he was saying we shouldn't murder Jews. He says we shouldn't kill them because they are a witness people, meaning they are condemned to wander the earth, and they are a reminder for us of what happens when you disobey God. That's what he meant when he called them a witness people. You know, we should leave the Jews alone because they're a constant reminder of what happens when you disobey God. You know, that was his idea. Now, I'm not picking on Justin. I'm not picking on Augustine. We could do these quotes all night, unfortunately. I sometimes say to my students, you know, you name a Christian theologian, I'll find you a statement like this. Now, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. There are some who didn't go down this road, but there were many who did. Next slide, please. John Chrysostom. John Chrysostom was the best-known preacher of his day. I say he's the Billy Graham of his day. He was the best known preacher of his day. He was the bishop of Constantinople, right? The major city in the East, Constantine's new capital, new Christian capital. John Chrysostom was the bishop there. He was considered, they called him the golden tongued because he was such a good orator and speaker. I was putting this PowerPoint together last night, and my wife came in the room, and she saw this quote, and she said, "Oh, that's terrible." I said, "Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it? It's terrible." She was stunned. She just, you know, she's like, "Why would a Christian bishop say this? This is pretty awful, isn't it? I'm not going to read it. You all can read it. It's pretty awful." The last line is what kills me. God always hated the Jews. Where did he get that? It's essential that all Christians hate them? You know what I think is the worst part about this? I have a feeling that when he preached this, nobody batted an eye. That's what I think probably happened when he said this. I don't think anybody thought this was odd, you know. We read it today and think, oh my, this is terrible. This is terrible. So I'm just giving you some samples here. I'll give you two more samples. Erasmus. Y'all know Erasmus? Erasmus was a 15th century, 16th century reformer, really. He was a humanist, which meant he wanted to study the early sources, you know. And he was very influential. He had a New Testament that people like Luther used and so forth. So he was a very influential theologian, writer, philosopher. If it's Christian to hate the Jews, then we're all good Christians. Again, I don't think anybody lost any sleep over this at that point. One more. This is a long one. I apologize for that, but I wanted you to get a grasp of this. I'll read this one. What shall we Christians do with this rejected and condemned people, the Jews? I will give you my sincere advice. First, to set fire to their synagogues and schools and bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. This is to be done to honor our Lord and of Christendom. Second, I advise their houses to be razed and destroyed. Third, I advise that their prayer books and Talmudic writings in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, blasphemy are taught be taken from them. Fourth, I advise their rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on pain of loss of life and limb. Fifth, I advise safe conduct on the highways to be abolished completely for the Jews. They have no business in the countryside, since they are not lords, tradesmen, or the like. Let them stay at home. Now, anybody notice anything ironic there? Let them stay at home. Didn't he say their houses should be destroyed already? Kind of shows you how irrational this is in some cases. Sixth, he says, I advise that usury is what? Lending at interest. Christians in the Middle Ages thought, you shouldn't lend at interest. But they were willing to allow Jews to lend at interest. Most Christian kings and princes in the Middle Ages had a Jewish banker who would lend money at interest. Now, what does this mean if you're a poor peasant and you need a loan? Who do you go to? The Jewish banker, right? And all the way, you're sort of muttering on your bet, they're sticking it to me. They're cheating me. They're charging me interest. Now, of course, the king and the prince are benefiting, but the Jewish banker gets blamed. Banking was something that Jews could do because they were prohibited from many occupations. They couldn't own land, for instance. And so he says, let them stay at home. He says, take all their cash. He says, seventh, I recommend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a spindle into the hands of young, strong Jews and Jewesses and letting them earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. Anybody know who said that? Anybody want to guess? Hit the slide for me. That was Martin Luther. Martin Luther. Now, if you didn't know it was Martin Luther, you're thinking, this sounds like the Nazis, right? Now, if you read that, that's exactly what the Nazis did, right? Nazis burned the synagogues. That looks like their program. Now, I don't want to, Luther didn't ever do this. He's just giving his advice, right? This is what he thinks you should do. He doesn't do it. He doesn't impose this. He just simply says, well, this is what I think we ought to do with these people. But you can kind of see the Nazi program here, right? Take their property, deny them, and so forth. So, unfortunately, this this is where everyone usually, in my experience, is feeling bad. My students, a lot of them, this is the first time they've been exposed to this history, and I look out and I see their faces, and they're just like stunned. It's not that they don't believe it. They've never heard it. They've never seen it. And so when you put it out there, it's like, wow. You know, it's like, really? And so this is always a shocking, stunning thing when you see these kinds of quotes. And again, I just picked a few examples. We could do this all night, unfortunately. But you get a sense of it, right? You're getting a sense of it. Next slide, please. So at some point, and I said earlier, at some point the line was crossed. Anti-Semitism was embraced. And anti-Semitism really is hatred of Jews and Judaism. And as I said, there's really a disconnect here between Jews and Christians. Jews, of course, know this history. Jews can tell you what Martin Luther said. They know. They've been taught in their communities. They can tell you what Justin Martyr said. They know. They've been taught. So they know the history. They know that, and for most Jews see this long history of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewishness as being very connected to Christianity. They see it as being very connected to Christianity. My experience, again, you all can let me know, my experience is most Christians are unaware of this tragic history. I know certainly I wasn't ever taught this in church. I suspect most of you are the same. I wasn't ever taught this in church. I learned about the Holocaust. We've learned about the Holocaust, right? Our schools are doing a much better job these days, I'm here to tell you, teaching about the Holocaust. It's in the curriculum in this state. Students get exposed to it. Even in middle school, they get exposed to it. I remember my daughter reading The Diary of Anne Frank, talking to me when she was a sixth grader, talking about the Holocaust. We're teaching about the Holocaust. But even when it comes to the Holocaust, there's still a disconnect. Most Jews look at the Holocaust not as an isolated event that happened because Nazis were crazy. They look at the Holocaust as the culmination of this very long history. And most Christians, when it comes to the Holocaust, don't see it that way. They haven't seen it that way, let me say. And so this is why the Holocaust and anti-Semitism is almost always an issue in Jewish-Christian dialogue. Jews want Christians to at least know what our own history is, because we don't know it as well as they do in some cases. And so this has, I think, since the end of World War II, this has really shaped Jewish-Christian dialogue. Next slide, please. Now, the good thing is, of course, is that Christians have acknowledged it. Christians have become much more aware of it. Certainly at the upper levels, scholars and so forth have acknowledged this. Many, many churches have confessed their faulty teaching in some areas, what was called the teaching of contempt. The Roman Catholic Church officially in the 1960s at Vatican II said, Jews should not be seen as Christ killers. And the word went down. This is not to be taught in Catholic contexts. That's good. That's a good thing. Other churches have done the same, renouncing these kinds of teachings, I would say. Pope John Paul II, the previous pope, was very highly regarded in the Jewish communities. They really appreciated him. They thought he had done a lot. I think he brought his own personal experience to this. John Paul II was a young man in World War II. He had Jewish friends. He knew what happened to them in Poland. He was from Poland, the previous pope was. So I think he brought his personal experience to bear on this issue, and the Jewish community appreciated it. He famously visited the synagogue in Rome in the early 1980s. It was very well received, and they thought that this was a very big step forward in Catholic-Jewish relations. And Protestants have done the same. And so I would say that certainly since World War II, there has been a sustained dialogue where Jews and Christians have intentionally engaged each other at all levels. Scholarly level, papers back and forth, talking about interpretation, talking about historical issues, but all the way down to the local level where you have, I know in Louisville they have, and you may have this here in Lexington, in Louisville there's been a group of Catholics and Jews who have been meeting together regularly for meals for 30 years. Now that is some dialogue there. You get to know each other. I've been a part of a lot of dialogues, and I can tell you one of the problems in dialogues is this. You say, let's have a dialogue. You get both sides to show up. You have a very nice conversation, and then everybody leaves, and you don't have any relationship. To really dialogue, you've got to know people because there has to be trust. And if you just show up for a meeting, as nice as that is, believe me, I planned a lot of these things. As nice as those meetings are, if there's no relationships there, you're not going to get very deep. You're not going to get very deep. And so that's why I'm so proud of this group in Louisville. I've talked to them a couple of times. They've been going for 30 years. They know each other really well. They kid each other. They make jokes. They make jokes about the other side's religion. You got to be really careful about that. But they know each other, and they trust each other where they can do that. And so this has all been happening, I think, post-World War II, and you're really seeing this going on. And so Jews and Christians have sustained, I would say, in very serious, very intentional dialogue. You're now seeing Jews and Christians together in organizations. There's the whole interfaith movement, right? The interfaith movement really is a post-World War II phenomenon. You know, before the war, it was mostly, okay, well, we'll cooperate with the Catholics. You know, we'll work with other Christians. But now it's Christians saying, no, we need to work with others. And so now you're seeing Jews and Christians working together. I know in Louisville, we build Habitat houses together. It's great, you know. And so this is all, I think, following up to the Holocaust, because the Holocaust was such an eye-opener for everybody. It's like, oh, my gosh, look at this. Look at what has happened, and look at the long, long history. And so this is all very positive. Next slide, please. Some other issues in dialogue, and then I want to let you all get in here a little bit. One of the big issues in Jewish-Christian dialogue is the State of Israel. The State of Israel came into existence in 1948 after the war. It was very clear to everybody after the Holocaust, Jews need a state that is their own, right? Jews need a state that is a Jewish state that will always accept Jews. Because the problem during World War II is that nobody wanted them, including the United States, by the way. That's a whole other topic. But we didn't let too many Jews in either during World War II. Only at the very end of the war did we start letting people in. They couldn't go anywhere. They needed to get out of Europe, but they couldn't go anywhere. Nobody would take them. And so the State of Israel was created. So the modern State of Israel, modern creation, created by the United Nations mandate, 1948, this is a big issue in Jewish-Christian relations. Many Christians, including some Christians that call themselves Christian Zionists, strongly support the nation of Israel. I have a good friend. Actually, he's living in Israel now, but he lived in Louisville for a long time. He's kind of mixed over this. As someone who is Jewish, he very much appreciates any support that he can find. He appreciates it. He also is well aware that as a Jew, some of these Christian groups are very, very politically conservative, much more so than most Jews are. So they're torn. They're torn over this movement. They want the support. They feel like they need the support. They often feel isolated in the world and so forth. And yet, they're a little weary or leery of getting too close to some Christian groups and so forth. So that's an issue. Missionizing, missionary efforts targeting Jews, this is almost always an issue that comes up. Somebody's asked me, I think after the first week or after last week, I had a couple of conversations with people who were asking me this question. Well, what about Messianic Jews? Have you all heard of Messianic Jews? Messianic Jews is sort of the modern incarnation of an old phenomenon. They used to be called Hebrew Christians. This is where you really see a clash. Remember the first week I talked about how to define Judaism, and there's an ethnic definition and there's an ideological definition? Of course, an ethnic definition says you're a Jew if your mother's a Jew. If you're born to a Jewish mother, you're a Jew. There's an ideological definition that says, well, these are the things that Jews believe and do. It's possible, of course, it's possible to be born a Jew and yet become a Christian, right? To be born a Jew, become a Christian. Some of these folks call themselves Messianic Jews today. They see themselves as Jewish. They say they haven't stopped being Jewish. And they've embraced Christian beliefs. So Messianic Jews, let me be clear, Messianic Jews are Christians, right? They're Christians. Jews don't have a problem with Christians. What they struggle with is a group that calls themselves Messianic Jews. Because they say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't care what your beliefs are, you can believe what you believe. But they say, Jews have never believed that Jesus is divine or the Messiah and so forth. So this is an ongoing issue. This is an ongoing issue that often comes up in Jewish-Christian dialogue. It's often something that's discussed and so forth. Obviously, ongoing issues of anti-Semitism come up. It's having a discussion we were talking before I got up to speak. In America, you know, most of what I was talking about earlier, those quotes and so forth, the worst context for Jews was medieval Europe. That was where they really, truly suffered. Jews have faced anti-Semitism in America. There have been incidents, certainly incidents in America, where Jews were opposed and where they were treated poorly, absolutely. But I have to say, nothing like medieval Europe. Nothing like medieval Europe went on like that. And so Jews have found in America a wonderful context. Jews have been in America since 1657, I think. 350 years. They see it as a wonderful place, land of opportunity, as many people have seen it. They have suffered anti-Semitism here, but not nearly as much as other places. But ongoing issues like this come up. Ongoing examples of anti-Semitism certainly come up. In some parts of the world today, you're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism, especially in the Middle East. Especially in the Middle East, where it gets wrapped up into the Nation of Israel issues. And so it gets really complicated pretty quickly and so forth. Now, I put the controversy over the Passion of the Christ film. Anybody remember that? Anybody remember the controversy? When the Passion of the Christ film was being advertised, before it came out, Jewish groups were nervous. They were nervous. They were concerned that what Hollywood was doing was updating the medieval Passion play. Passion plays were these very common phenomenon in the Middle Ages, where Christian actors would put on the story of the Christ, the last week of Jesus' life, which obviously is very meaningful for Christians, right? They would put on a play called a Passion Play. And in the Passion Play, of course, they recount the events of Jesus' life. And it all comes to a climax, of course, in that scene that we see in Matthew 27, right? Where Jesus is there, and Pilate is there, and Pilate says, you know, who do you want me to release, you know? And the crowd shouts, Barabbas, give us Barabbas. What should I do with Jesus? Crucify him. Pilate's like, his blood's not on me. And what does the crowd yell? His blood be on us and on our children. And Christian theologians have done a lot with that through the ages. They said, well, that's right. That's it right there. That's the perpetual curse right there. And so I will tell you that in some medieval passion plays, after they were performed, the crowd watching this play got so worked up, got so angry at those Jews who killed Jesus in the play, that they went out and they killed Jews. So when the Passion of the Christ was being advertised, Jews were nervous. They thought, oh, this is a medieval passion play. Christians, for the most part, didn't know what a medieval passion play was, so they're like, what's the problem here? You know, I had a very interesting experience with this film. The religious reporter for the Courier Journal, the newspaper in Louisville, he called me up one day. He said, well, you know, this film's coming out. And he said, what we want to do at the paper, we want to get together a group of, a diverse group from different religions. We want you all to watch the film together. And then we want you to talk about it. And so I was invited on this thing. And so there were like four rabbis, a couple of Christians, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim. You know, it was kind of a, you know, hodgepodge. We went and watched the film. I was sitting next to my Reform rabbi friend. We came out of the film. The rabbis were appalled. They were appalled. They were appalled at this film because it's filled with medieval anti-Semitic caricatures. Now, I saw some of them just because of my interest in this. Most Christian audiences wouldn't see these things. But the rabbis were appalled. They thought it was awful, the presentation in the film. Most Christians, of course, have seen that film. I suspect a lot of you have seen this film. How many people have seen The Passion of the Christ? Okay, I thought so. Most Christians are deeply moved by this film. It's hard not to be deeply moved by this film in a lot of ways. So it was very clear, and we had some interesting discussion. And my rabbi friend and I had him to my church to talk about this. And he said, This was a couple months after the film had come out, and he came to my church and he said, I am so glad that Christians in America don't realize how anti-Semitic this film is. He was troubled by the film, but he was so glad. And of course, we saw no anti-Semitism in the United States as a result, because that's not the message that Christians took from the film. And my observation was, I said, you know what happens here? You all probably had this experience. We watched the same film, but we saw very different things. We watched the same film, but we saw and experienced very different things. And to me, that sort of encapsulates the Jewish-Christian relationship. We have so much in common on the one hand, and yet we have these very different histories. Christianity became the majority in Europe. It dominated. Judaism has always been a minority. Or at least in for the past 2,000 years, has been a minority religion. And as a minority religion, it has struggled to survive, literally survive. And so from a Jewish perspective, one question they would have for Christians is, well, the Jews understand Christians, and they say, well, we understand that we know you're called to spread the word, right? And I know this is a great missionary-minded church. We believe in this. We go overseas. They understand that Christians have a mandate to do that, to spread their faith. But sometimes they wonder, they say, well, you know, if you were successful and if you converted every Jew in the world, that would be the end of Judaism. And they wonder, is that really God's plan? Is that the idea? You know, they wonder. They don't know, but they wonder about that. So, you know, again, we sometimes sort of like ships in the night, right? We're passing each other, thinking we know about each other when in fact we don't necessarily know about each other. I've done all the talking. We've got a few minutes. I'd be very happy to entertain some questions. Any questions anybody has? This is your chance. Yeah, I see one back there. Sure. Well, and that's the case. I mean, it's interesting. You know, there's lots of, I was kind of using this generic term up there, anti-Semitism, you know, but really there's lots of different types of anti-Semitism. And one of the things that, and I see this with my students a lot, you know, I'll ask them, I'll say, well, what are your perceptions of Jews and Judaism? And, you know, a lot of times they'll say, well, you know, Jews are, as a group, they're wealthier, which, by the way, is actually true. I mean, if I were to give you sort of a chart showing you the social economic status of different religious groups, they're always near the top. They're not necessarily number one, but they're near the top, along with like Unitarians and Episcopalians and so forth. But so they're always near the top, you know. And there's a good reason for this. One of the reasons is the fact that Jews have historically valued education very, very highly. And this goes right along with the Rabbinic Judaism program, right? How are you to be a good Jew? Study. Study the Torah. And so study, and academic study, has always been very important in Judaism. And so they have tended to go into the professions. They have tended to go to professional school. Many of them do. And so you have a lot of doctors and lawyers who are Jewish. That's true. I mean, there's no secret here. I'm not telling any secrets here. And because they have valued education, and they have worked very hard. In some cases, at least if you go back far enough, some of that was driven by the fact that they were restricted from certain occupations. You know, there were laws which did not permit them to function in certain kinds of occupations, which tended to drive them into other occupations. Merchant, you mentioned merchant. Merchant trade was one of the things that medieval Jews were very deeply engaged in. Because buying and selling of goods was something they could do. They couldn't own land. If you can't own land, how are you going to make a living? There were only certain kinds of things they were permitted to do. And so you're exactly right. And people develop relationships in all kinds of different ways. And this is absolutely the case. So other questions, please. Yeah, right back there. Oh, yeah, that's a good question. The question here was the parallel covenants or the two-covenant kind of theology, that there was a covenant for Jews and then a separate, different covenant for Christians. I'm not sure I can put my finger on the origin. I know it was certainly something that was promoted by someone like John Calvin, who did say negative things about Jews, but also, because he had this sort of dual covenant approach, had a very positive assessment, much more so than some of his colleagues in the Middle Ages. So the dual covenant approach, some Jews, they can appreciate it. They can say, well, hey, listen, you know, we may disagree over interpretation of Scripture and so forth, but the idea that there was a covenant that made a way for Gentiles to come in, that is in keeping with their theology, really. Because, of course, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, what do you see in the Hebrew Bible? You have a lot of this language about that Jews are to be the shining city on the hill, right? That they are to draw all nations to themselves. The Jewish view of mission is not necessarily to go out, it's to draw in. And so the dual covenant really fits in quite nicely with that. And there are a lot of Christians today that embrace this idea that there's a covenant for Jews and there's a covenant for Christians. You know, I think I have read this passage often. If you want to look at a New Testament passage which may be dealing with this, I would suggest you look at like Romans 9 through 11. I think Paul is struggling there in Romans 9 through 11 with this question, what about my own people, he says, the Jews? Now, Paul, I absolutely convinced, believes that the way is through Jesus the Christ, right? That's the way. He's convinced of that, but he's wondering to himself, what is the role? What's the relationship for Jews? And he says some very interesting things there. He talks about the remnant, you know. He talks about how some branches of the tree are broken off and others are going to be grafted in, and he's clearly talking about the Gentiles there. It's a very interesting passage. And I think Paul is sort of grappling within his own self. How do I answer this question? And by the way, this is a vexing question for us. You know, this is not an easy question for us. You know, some of us well aware. Remember, we are well aware of statements that have been made. You know, the famous statement. What was it? 1980. Bailey Smith said, "God does not hear the prayer of a Jew." At his convention, I think he said this. And there were people who said, "Really? God doesn't hear the prayer of a Jew?" You know, and so it kind of raised an interesting debate. So this is something that we are still grappling with in a lot of ways. You know, for us as Christians, we clearly have beliefs about Jesus as the Christ. And yet, when it comes to Jews and Judaism, we see this long history, we see this scripture that we share with them, we see these promises made to them, and we struggle with that. And this is actually a really ripe area for dialogue. And the thing I would encourage you when you have dialogue is, don't necessarily just stick with the easy stuff. Dive right in, you know. People are usually aware of the differences, and they're actually, once there's a trust level, they're willing to share and say, well, no, this is what I think about that, you know. And we can agree to disagree. You know, as I said, one of the best experiences I had was that time up in Cincinnati, going up there every week, sitting with a group of Reform rabbis in training who were really interested in us. They wanted to know, what do you think about the professor? Do you think he's right? What do you think about this? And we were interested in them as well. Now, I will tell you one funny story about this. These are Reform rabbis, right? So Reform Jewish school. So they're on the liberal end, right? We would show up every week and we would pull into the parking lot, and it would never fail. There was always the same parking space that was empty. And we convinced ourselves, the three of us, the three Baptists driving up together, that they were somehow leaving that parking space open for us. It was the Goy space. We even thought, well, maybe they're setting it aside because of some kind of ritual contamination or something. I'm embarrassed to say this. But we really convinced ourselves, because every week the same spot was open. And so, you know, we talked about this. And one week, we finally shared this with one of the students. And they fell on the ground laughing at us. They thought, you are crazy. What are you talking about? You thought that we would separate you in the parking lot? You know. And so I thought, well, okay. I'm learning. And so, yes, that's exactly what we thought. We really had this idea that, well, maybe they're not wanting to become contaminated. Maybe they didn't want us to contaminate the parking lot or the campus or something. It was crazy. One final thought, yeah. Yeah.
And quizzes and so on and so forth. And one thing I saw in the religion is that the Jews wanted an earthly king.
Mm.
And
yeah.
We wanted a heavenly king.
Right. Right.
To do this and this and on down the line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, all the provinces, that's why they had tax collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to looking at the money and everything, and it's either Caesar or God.
Mm-hmm. Well, you raise a good point, and this kind of goes back to the earlier thing I said about Messiah. What were Jews in the first century looking for with regard to Messiah, an earthly kingdom? What did Christianity seem to be focused on? A spiritual kingdom. Again, another point for productive, I think, dialogue about expectations and so forth. So I think our time is at an end, right? So thank you all very much. I've appreciated your attention. It's been good. My church next week.